My name is Katie Gillespie, and this is a talk that I gave at the Institute for Critical Animal Studies conference this year at the beginning of March in 2012. The title of the talk is Joining the Resistance: Farmed Animals Making History. My interest in animal resistance and animal social movements comes out of my research on animals in the food system. For my master's thesis, I wrote about humane slaughter in the United States meat industry. The project looked at federal and state legislation, as well as industry recommendations and farm discourses on humane slaughter. Ultimately, the project worked to reconceptualize humane slaughter and challenge the notion that slaughter can be humane. Out of this work, I noticed that while there was a relatively strong body of work on meat production in the United States, the subject of dairy production had been relatively understudied. My dissertation work focuses on the life course of the cow in dairy production at both the industrial scale and the small-scale family farm in the Pacific Northwest. It looks at the commodification of the cow and the gendered use of the animal body. Beyond the quintessential female milk-producing dairy cow, there is the complex network of other bovine actors: female calves, male calves, and adult bulls. Their bodies are used differently, and their productive and reproductive capabilities are exploited in different spaces. Focusing on the life course of the dairy cow, I began to think more deeply about the individual experience of the animal within the food industry, rather than in a more monolithic sense of the abstract suffering and slaughter of billions of animals each year. David Wolfson says that, quote, "When discussing the treatment of such a large number of animals, it is hard not to write either in a droning monotone or somewhat sensationally. It is not simply billions of animals a year, but it is one and one and one, amounting to the large-scale mistreatment of individual animals," end quote. I wanted to know what that one's life was like, how that one lived and died, why the public perception of dairy production was that it was benign, and how an individualized analysis of the dairy cow might begin to change this perception and provide more nuanced information on the ethical, political dimensions of dairy. It is this focus on the individual that led me to Jason Reibel's work on the role of animals in a new kind of labor history, and the importance of recognizing the agency of animals and their membership as property in an albeit unpaid working class. This focus on the agency of individual animals and their experience as members of a laboring class sheds light on animals as engaging in intentional resistance, as we have seen in the case of humans in human histories of labor. Reibel's recent book, Fear of the Animal Planet: The Hidden History of Animal Resistance, draws on examples from the entertainment industry primarily, circuses, aquariums, and zoos, to tell the stories of animals who have resisted the way they were treated. This resistance emerges from what Gary Francione, Bob Torres, and others would argue is a wrongly assigned property status for animals. Situated within a Marxist framework, economic critiques of capitalism and the commodification of both the human and non-human animal in this system are made at length elsewhere. Animals' conditions and the way their bodies are used are dictated largely by their economic value as commodities, in particular by the way their reproductive and productive capabilities are amplified and capitalized on via genetic engineering, forced reproduction, and commodity extraction, for example, milk, meat, and semen, and ultimately by their status as property. David Favor outlines the three types of property in the current United States legal system. The first is real property, which is property fixed in space, like land. The second is personal property, which can be transported, like a laptop computer. The third is intellectual property, which is the product of the human mind. Favor explains that animals currently fall under the category of personal property, but he argues that this is an inaccurate placement. Animals differ in important ways from a laptop computer, for instance. Favor argues not to abolish animals' property status, but to redefine exactly the kind of property they are. He advocates a fourth type of property, living property, to more accurately describe animals' place in human society. According to Favor, creating a new property status for animals would naturally lead to more rights for animals and ultimately more humane treatment. Gary Francione, on the other hand, critiques the animal welfare and humane treatment movement and argues that so long as animals are categorized as property, they will be exploited by humans because human economic interests will, most of the time, trump animal interests. Drawing on the historic human example of the legal abolition of human slavery in the historic U.S. American South, He draws comparisons between the legal structures that kept humans enslaved and the structure by which animals are owned by humans today. Prior to abolition, he argues, there were humane slavery campaigns to improve the welfare of those who were enslaved. This humane movement was unsuccessful because it proposed a, quote, three-tiered system. Things, or inanimate property, persons, who were free, and in the middle, depending on your choice of locution, quasi-persons, or things plus, the slaves, end quote. The trouble with this structure, according to Francione, is that, quote, the moral universe is limited to only two kinds of beings, persons and things. Quasi-persons, or things plus, will necessarily risk being treated as things because the principle of equal consideration cannot apply to them, end quote. It only applies to persons. As property, Gary Francione argues that, quote, animals are commodities that we own and have no value other than that which we as property owners choose to give them, end quote. Certainly, humans and animals have complex non-economic interpersonal relationships that complicate Francione's claim that animals are solely commodities, and even in the case where animals are commodified, the presence of a concerned or compassionate owner would make a significant difference in the quality of the animal's life. Further, legal overtures have been made in the form of welfare and humane treatment laws to try to discourage cruelty and regulate the treatment of animals by humans. Yet Gary Francione, Bob Torres, and others argue that these laws are notoriously lax and insufficiently enforced, and that similar to the case of the humane human slavery movement, so long as animals are categorized as property and not as persons, their interests will frequently be compromised to the interests of human owners. If we look at the lived experience of animals in the food system, in entertainment, in experimentation, and in fashion, we can see that economic interests often dictate their lives, and even more often, their deaths. Particularly with the rise of industrialized capitalism, animals' bodies and lives have been increasingly pressured to produce commodity goods and labor. To draw on the example of the dairy cow, between 1987 and 2007, the number of dairy cows in the U.S. declined by 11%, the number of dairy farms declined by 69%, and the number of cows per farm increased by 183%. Meanwhile, during the same time period, the overall milk production of cows in the U.S. has increased by 30%, meaning that fewer cows are producing more milk on fewer farms than ever before. This documents a process familiar throughout much of modern agriculture, the consolidation and intensification of the food system. Female dairy cows are annually impregnated and used for the production of milk until their productivity wanes, and they are slaughtered at 4 to 5 years of age, while most male calves are slaughtered at approximately 6 months of age for veal. By contrast, the natural lifespan of a dairy breed cow is upwards of 20 years. Female calves are born into the system are often raised as dairy cows. A few male adults are kept to produce semen, a process by which they are forcibly ejaculated by human or machine. Even on small-scale farms, male calves are often either slaughtered for veal or auctioned off at the stockyard since they are of limited use to dairy producers. As the property of farmers, dairy cows are a somewhat unique group of animals because of the way their bodies are used for their productive and reproductive capacities while they are alive, through milk, semen, and reproduction, and then their bodies are commodified again in death when they are slaughtered and converted into meat. Fundamentally, the way cows and other animals' bodies are used are dependent on their being property and not persons. And as external observers, we can acknowledge that there may be ethical and political dilemmas emerging from this status. However, new insights might be gained from looking at the trend of animal resistance. In other words, the way in which animals themselves oppose the conditions that their property status dictates. Tatiana, a Siberian tiger at the San Francisco Zoo, escaped her enclosure and passed by numerous bystanders to kill and maim three teenagers who had teased, taunted, and thrown things at her. She was hunted down and shot to death by park security. Janet, an elephant at the Great American Circus, chased down and tried to injure circus employees while she had a group of children riding on her back. In the middle of the chaos, she stopped, let someone remove the children safely from her back, and then continued to chase the employees. She grabbed a bull hook, which they had often used to beat her, and smashed it repeatedly against a wall. A group of baboons in northern Africa resisted the slaughter and capture of members of their community by animal traders, and chased the animal traders all the way to the train station, launching raids on the trade cars and to try to free the captured baboons. Tilikum, captive orca at SeaWorld, has killed trainers on several occasions, pinning them to the bottom of his tank until they drown to death. Stories of animal resistance are numerous and varied. Media coverage and public relations discourse on these events presents them as isolated incidents, as, quote, animals gone wild, as individual animals being a bad seed, or simply as accidents. Ribal presents these stories in a different light. If looked at not as isolated incidents, but as a rich and varied history of animals intentionally resisting, these individual and collective actions can be read as a new kind of social movement. Ribal writes, quote, captive animals escaped their cages, they attacked their keepers, they demanded more food, they refused to perform, they refused to reproduce. The resistance itself could be organized. Indeed, not only did the animals have a history, they were making history, for their resistance led directly to historical change, end quote. A fraction of these kinds of stories make it into the public light, and yet those that do often spur academics, activists, and concerned citizens to reflect on issues relating to agency, welfare, captivity, and domestication. Ribal's most recent work is focused on the entertainment industry and the politics of captivity in relation to animal resistance struggles. Drawing on an example related to my own work on dairy production, Yvonne, a 6-year-old dairy cow in Germany, provides an interesting example of resistance. In May 2011, just before Yvonne was to be collected and sent to slaughter, she broke through an electric fence and escaped the farm where she was being kept. She hid in the forest and eluded capture for several months before she was caught and returned to her owners. During her period of freedom, she had become a national icon, and the public traveled across the country to try to spot a glimpse of her living in the forest. Yvonne was labeled by media sources as, quote, a freedom fighter for the animal-loving republic and an incandescent symbol of freedom and animal dignity. In the end, the public rallied to save her from slaughter, and an animal sanctuary purchased her for 600 euros so that she could live out her days at the sanctuary. Farmed animals in particular are an interesting group for thinking about the resistance of non-human animals. Ribal writes, quote, most owners, managers, or observers of laboring animals, whether through their written word or through their counteractions, fully admit to the presence of such resistance. These acts could be maliciously violent in form, horses bucked, cattle charged, cows kicked, pigs bit, chickens pecked, all with the recognized intent that is recognized by the employers themselves, to harm or kill the employers. Or it could be non-violent in form, such as refusing to work, or at least work hard, end quote. As the exploitation increased, so did their resistance to it, both by laboring animals and concerned humans. In many cases, animal resistance is not tolerated by the meat and dairy industries. In fact, tendencies toward resistance are attempted to be bred out of farmed animals, and animals who do resist, especially those who resist on multiple occasions, are routinely killed because they're perceived as dangerous or as simply too much trouble. Dairy cows have been bred to be increasingly docile, and yet 1% of dairy cows, for instance, go to slaughter because their dispositions have turned nasty after the repeated seizure of their calves away from them. Matthew Cole argues that, quote, the very behaviors that are subject to the interventions of animal welfare science, such as stereotypies or tail biting in the case of pigs, are evidence of resistance to the norms of factory farm discipline, end quote. Richard Twine explores the impacts of biotechnology on the farmed animal body, and in fact we can see that at the biological level, animals' bodies are resisting the processes to which they are subject. In the case of turkeys whose breasts grow too big for them to stand, laying hens whose bones are so weak they break, and cows who are prone to lameness and mastitis. Individual and collective animal resistance has discursive and potentially political power. As we consider the way in which this resistance is its own kind of social movement. Jeffrey St. Clair, in his introduction to Ribal's most recent book, says, quote, each trampling of a brutal handler with a bullhook, each mauling of a taunting visitor, each drowning of a tormenting trainer is a crack in the old order that treats animals as property, as engines of profit, as mindless objects of exploitation and abuse. The animal rebels are making their own history, and Jason Ribal serves as their Michelet. End quote. Thinking seriously about animal agency and resistance in the context of a new kind of social movement may be a location for disrupting the status quo that categorizes animals as property. and it also might be a place to look at the animal rights movement and human struggles for freedom from economic and political oppression, like Occupy, in a slightly different light. Animal resistance is certainly not new, and animal rescue workers, rights activists, and farmers acknowledge that animals surely do resist. This conference has focused so far on human social movements for animals, but I think exciting new possibilities may emerge when we decenter the human in these movements and meet animals who are resisting on their own terms. What might we learn from them? Other potentially fruitful questions moving forward focus not only on how or why animals resist, but on what this resistance means for social change in human and non-human animal society. How exactly might taking animal resistance seriously begin to forge a crack in the old order that treats animals as property, as St. Clair suggests? How might humans reimagine our roles and responsibilities in relation to the current legal status of animals as property? And how might human social movements that have typically been working for animal welfare or rights begin to recognize this resistance and work with animals as one step to reimagining the animal's status as property? What possibilities emerge for interspecies social movements that address intersections of human and animal oppression? What might we learn from taking seriously this resistance on animals' own terms? And what might a new collaborative movement look like? And how might human social movements learn from taking seriously the histories of non-human animal social movements of resistance? Thank you.